Boom. What is happening, good people of the podcast land? My name is Jack Nagel, and this is another show or episode of Real Drug Talk. And on this show, we talk about all things drugs, alcohol, addiction, addiction recovery, and anything else interesting in the space. Really cool show today. Our guest has had quite the experience and quite the life and has some really interesting insights on his experience with drugs, alcohol, and addiction. Before I tell you a little bit more about that, as always, this show is brought to you by Connection Based Living, which is our outpatient coaching program that we run where we teach people how to beat addictive patterns without having to go to rehab. So if that sounds of interest to you, you've wanted to make change, you know you need to do something a little bit more intensive, but you don't necessarily want to engage in the traditional treatment sector and systems, we might be able to help. So click the link below, have a bit of a read, give us a call, and we can have a chat and see how we might be able to help. And if we can't, we can point in the right direction. So that's connection-based living. Links are below. Have a click around and have a look. On the show today, we've got artist and prolific creator Ben Aiken, which is a really interesting chat and a really interesting story that he has. And he's actually from the same area that I grew up in, which we found out as we're kind of chatting on the gram, trying to sort out the podcast and stuff. So I think he went to the same school as me, actually. It was interesting for me to just kind of chat to someone from that area, has a bit of nostalgia, or I don't know, it's just weird. It's just relatable in some way. So I really enjoyed the show. To give you a bit of an idea about Ben, he sent me through the coolest fucking bio, just in terms of like how it was written, that I've ever received. And you can tell that he's like a cool dude, an artist, fucking talented, all that shit. I'm not going to read it because I tried to read it in another recording that we did. And as most people know, I'm kind of a bit of a spastic when it comes to reading, and I just mess it up. Doesn't sound good. So, but I will put it in the show description. You can have a read, and I would recommend you have a read because it's cool. But to give you an idea, Ben won the 2018 Tony Fanini Foundation Prize, Art Gallery of Western Australia, and was a finalist in the Archibald Prize 2019, 2018, and 2017. He's basically a prolific, well-known, credentialed artist that has some really cool stuff. Recommend you go and check him out on the gram that we'll link to below, and all the things that he does, because it's really cool. And that's why we're chatting to him on our show. Had some challenges with substances, and if you like, some kind of a fall from grace, if you want to call it that, or just things kind of blew up a couple of years ago. Had some really negative media stories around him and his situation that are super stigmatizing and, really interesting to hear about. He's had some interesting experiences with treatment and, how he thinks about himself and his relationships to alcohol and drugs. And, just a really, honest, interesting, authentic account of like what it's like when you're going through this whole thing and then you're trying to work out how to make things different in your life and all the fucking shit that you have to sort of come up against. So really interesting episode. I hope you guys enjoy it. Good to be back on the airwaves. And I'll shut up now because the intro's going for ages. But thanks for everyone for listening as always. Last thing before we jump into the show, if you like what we're putting down, we would love it if you could like and subscribe to us on whatever channel you're listening. I think we're up to about like 12,000 people on YouTube. I keep saying it, but we will put some extra energy and effort into it. Go and like us on YouTube if you're not listening to us there. We'll have some original content and shit coming out on there. And have a good day. Stay safe, everyone, and catch you in the episode. Peace. Boom. What's happening, everyone? Welcome to another podcast. I'm excited about today because I've had a couple of these like funny ones happening lately where we go to interview some people that there's like a connection from my past and like growing up and stuff. So I always kind of get like excited because I can't remember half the shit that like happened in my life back then. And it always like jogs my memory a little bit. And yeah, it's interesting to hear other people's experiences. So our guest today, Ben Aitken, is kind of from around the area that I grew up in and went, and I think we went to the same school. Is that right? Is that what we've worked out? Maybe like different years, but same school.
Same school. You were 1 year above me.
That's right. There we go.
I'm sure we did something together at one point that we can't remember.
That's right. So how are you, mate? Thanks for coming on. Excited to chat today. How you going?
Yeah, good, my friend. Pleasure to be on it. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. No worries. Yeah, so we connected over Instagram just on some stuff. I think you said that you'd listened to the podcast and then yeah, just recently you've done like a pretty big significant media story as well. So yeah, interested to kind of hear a bit of your story and your experience with that. So how we might start is let's just kind of go with like the 3-minute snapshot. Do you want to tell me like, yeah, just the elevator snapshot of your life? I know it's probably hard to fit it all in 3 minutes, but you know, and then we'll roll from there.
Yeah. Probably pretty classic to most people that grew up in our area, really just hanging around the wrong people, a bit bored at school or didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
And then, just getting into the wrong drugs really young.
Yeah.
And then it just starts to escalate and probably not really realizing or having any idea about how important your mental health is, basically. And just a lot of the, you know, stuff that happened when I was a kid, underlying issues that I never dealt with.
Yeah.
And then, sort of spiraled out of control, like quite a few of our lives from that school.
Yeah.
And then I've sort of, ended up here in this sort of on and off recovery. I think as you know, it's going to be a journey probably for the rest of our lives, but.
Yeah, man. It's, So do you mind giving us an insight? Because that's interesting. I'd be interested to hear your perspective on this as well, because, you know, there's like the common narrative around, you know, people that have problems with drugs is that you come from this really like low socioeconomic kind of background, life's fucked, all this sort of stuff. And yeah, it's interesting that you say that, like people from, you know, around that area in the school we went to, there was like so many people that ended up just having like some challenges with drugs, mental health, all different kinds of stuff. Like, what was your upbringing like? Was it, you know, sort of average? Did you have like challenging stuff going on when you were growing up? Like, yeah, give us a bit of an insight into what your upbringing was like.
I had a pretty good family, man. It's a middle-class family, really supportive parents. We moved around a lot. Dad was in the army. Yeah. Once we hit sort of me and my sisters hit high school, we stayed in Melbourne and I didn't have a bad family or anything like that. There was some sexual abuse when I was 7 that was not a family member.
Yeah.
Make that clear. And so that was something that I sort of, you know, blocked out and have been working through over the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And I was just sort of waiting for a time in my life that's not so hectic and to start some trauma therapy and really work through that.
Yeah.
But like there's so many different walks of life for people who get into drugs. And like you said, like, you know, our area sort of intersects a bit of shittier suburbs with some affluent suburbs, but you know, at Sandy, everyone was, you know, just everyone had a different story. But like, it's the same with something that I've really been thinking about lately is the same with drug dealers. I mean, you got people coming from really low socioeconomic commission housing, you know, unsupported families. There's obviously some, you know, racial minorities as well. But on the same token, you've got people like me who really just sort of, you know, was in a position to really make better choices.
Yeah.
It's really across the board with both addicts and consumers, which I find really interesting, and a lot of people sort of forget that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. It's like I always say that to people. People find it hard to believe what it's now. I don't actually know what it's like, but, you know, like there was like when I was growing up, Hyatt, like don't get me wrong, it wasn't like Broadmeadows or anything, but, yeah, it was kind of a bit – yeah, there was the commission flats there and there was, yeah, like some different stuff going on right in the middle of, yeah, like the affluent suburbs. And it's funny, now you go to Hyatt and you can't fucking get an apartment under a million. It's crazy, man. And like, yeah, when I was growing up, I just used to think like, oh, I'm never going to fucking live in Hyatt. And now it's like now it's a sought after place. So it's funny how shit changes and how things
change. Hyatt was a ghetto.
Yeah. It's funny, man. It is funny. Okay. So, talk us through your story a bit. Like, so when did drug use like start for you? How did it start? What was going on at that time in your life? What kind of drugs were they? All that kind of stuff.
I jumped the gun pretty quick. Like, I didn't really touch like a lot of drugs. You know, when I was young, like, you know, a lot of people talk about their addictions and it's like they start using it like 13, 14, 15. I smoked weed like once at high school, greened out.
Yep.
Had mushrooms at high school once, freaked out. And then those were pretty much the two times I just really had done drugs for the first time. And then I just went pretty much straight to oxys and heroin.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then that was sort of like my thing. And then obviously Zannies, I was just eating those like Tic Tacs. They sort of go alongside that sort of culture.
Yeah.
So yeah, that sort of happened in, yeah, towards the end of year 12.
Yeah.
There was a massive group of us that were all just really getting into the oxys back when they were, you know, obviously a lot easier to get 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, cheap when, too. Yeah. And yeah, when that stuff, you know, It's classic. When that stuff clears up, like the next thing you do is smack, and then I don't know that many people who have maintained a healthy relationship with just smoking it and not moving on to injecting. But at some point, for me, it just got to that, and I think it maybe was a year after high school. I just remember being at this factory job and just being like, I don't even know what was going through my head, but I was just like, oh, I just want to shoot up. And then I just walked out the door and just went to the flats and, yeah, got on. And then sort of I was always sort of like I was able to sort of not manage my addiction in a sense that, like, it was obviously affecting my life and my mental health, but I was still getting up and going to work. You know, I wasn't really hurting other people in a physical sense. And then, yeah, that went on for a few years. And then I took myself to a residential rehab, which became like a really distasteful experience for me and with rehabs.
Yep.
You know, I've since been to another rehab that was quite similar and it put a pretty bad taste in my mouth. But, yeah.
So there's a few things that I want to unpack there, yeah, particularly with that rehab stuff, because it's interesting. Because I guess, like, and it's why we love talking to you know, people like yourself that have a personal story, because so many people listening to this, yeah, that are looking for help and answers, but we actually get a lot of like professionals listening to this as well. And sometimes I can find that there's like a bit of a disconnect between, I guess like what maybe some professionals think is what people need and want and all that stuff versus what people's experience is and what actually helps them. And yeah, it's really interesting just to kind of hear that uncut experience. So I want to talk to you more about that. So you started like with the oxys and, you know, got into heroin and all that kind of stuff. And you mentioned, yeah, obviously it was affecting your mental health, but you was kind of like holding your life together, like with work and stuff like that. In that time, because I guess people just think about, you know, people using heroin as like, yeah, just sprawled out in the middle of Victoria Street or something. and it's not like that. So what kind of a guy were you in? Were you into like sports? Were you into, I don't know, like music or like art, or, you know, like were you out like doing stuff with friends and things like that as well, still living a normal life, or were things like slowly starting to change and go downhill?
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning, I mean, look, it was because there was a group of us, it was sort of relatively social in a way, even when we were using every day. We'd still go, we used to all get on and go 10 pin bowling and just stupid shit like that. But eventually it's, you know, friends like drop off, or, you know, they make their own decision to go on a different journey and make some better decisions. So slowly the group sort of dissipated and it become less social and just more of a, you know, I have to use this shit to feel good.
Yeah.
And obviously no one wants to go through smack withdrawals.
Yeah.
But it'd just be one of those things. I'd always combat like getting off that by just getting on Xannies.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'd always struggle with drinking as well. So like you put those two together, as we all know, you can't remember anything.
Yeah.
And God knows what you get up to. I mean, I've heard some stories, but yeah. It just slowly was getting a bit of like an emotional toll. I was still going to work. And yeah. I just remember one day being at work and like just thinking I can't do this and this is not going to last.
Yeah.
And then I just took myself to a doctor and pretty much I was in rehab, I think, like that next day.
Yeah. So yeah, talk us through that. What was your experience with rehab like, and what did you find, yeah, kind of like frustrating and distasteful about that process?
I think for me, like, it's a little bit unique. Just because I was sort of, you know, I got brought up going to like a Pentecostal church.
Yeah.
Which, you know, as I got older, I really sort of, you know, was really resentful about, I guess, being, I don't even indoctrinated is the right word, but just going to something where that I didn't understand, where I wasn't really at an age of any accountability. And then this rehab that I went to was a Christian-based rehab.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like a lot of AA and NA is the 12 steps thing. It's sort of about a higher power at least.
Yeah.
But this one was really like hooly-dooly Christian shit.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just, you know, it just didn't gel with me. It didn't align with my values. The thing that I did get out of it, though, was the time. Like, you know, I was there for about, it was a residential place, and I was there for about 5.5 months.
Yeah.
So the time.
It's amazing you stayed. It's amazing you stayed, man. It's amazing you stayed.
Yeah, because, I mean, there were some people there that had to be there because they were on bail.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think I was so young. I was like 22 or something. So there's probably a bit of like pride there as well.
Yeah.
Just sort of hanging on, trying to like prove to everyone else that, you know, that I could do it. Cause it was a 12-month program. So I did nearly half of it. And after, 5.5 months, I'd had a gutful. But that time away from that, you know, the environment that I was in, even though I hadn't dealt with my mental health issues properly.
Yeah.
That was still, I felt it was really valuable. You know, I managed to not do drugs from then for about 5 years. I was still a really heavy drinker.
Yeah.
And that sort of built up a lot.
Yeah.
And then, after about 5 years going through just a breakup, then I was just like, it went down. Xanax was the first thing to come into the picture.
Yeah.
Once I'd done that and sort of felt like I had things under control, I was like, oh, well, I can have oxys again. And then it just went downhill again, and then I got into everything. And then, you know, later in my later 20s, started dealing drugs again, and was just like, yeah, just sort of really spun out of control for the last, last 4 years or something.
Yeah, it's interesting, man. I had the similar experience in rehab, and it kind of sounds the same. Like, and don't get me wrong, mine doesn't sound as in that I went to as intense as that. Like, yeah, real like holy dooly religious stuff. But yeah, there was a lot of the 12-step stuff being discussed, and you know, the God thing and whatever. And to be honest, like, that shit just did not connect with me at all. Like, I remember the only, like, I never grew up in any like religious sort of environment when I was a kid, and the only experience I had of like spirituality was like some of the cats that went to school with that were like really into acid and would just like say fucking the weirdest shit where they'd be tripping out, and I just thought it was weird, you know. So I remember when I felt fucked and I went to rehab, and then, you know, they were like telling me to pray and stuff. I remember, and I was the same. I was like 21. I remember just thinking, what the fuck is going on? But yeah, there was just that big part of me that wanted my life to be different. So I just kind of just ignored it and worked out how to fight through it. It sounds the same, you know, that you just, you managed to just kind of hang on for 5 months. And kind of get through it. So the rehab that you went to recently, was it similar or had some of the same aspects as well?
Yeah, it was pretty much the same, almost an identical sort of model. I feel like it's been adopted from something in America, and it seems like a fucking pyramid scheme of rehabs, really, to be honest. Definitely question if anyone there has a proper tertiary qualification.
But okay, beautiful people, quick interruption on the podcast. I've been told that we have to talk about and promote our connection-based living service a little more, because we're getting some great results, and people are telling me that we don't hear enough about it. So I thought this was an opportune time just to have a quick interruption. I'm not going to bang on too much about it, but to let you know that, as I said at the start of the show, and I do at the most, at most of the start of our shows, is that we run an outpatient coaching program called Connection-Based Living, where we help people to beat and overcome addictive patterns without having to go to rehab. So the way that we run is that, yeah, we have a unique model of care and way that we approach addiction recovery. Just to give you a bit of an insight, yeah, you don't have to check into a facility, but you still get the intensity of what you would do in a rehab program. But you can still do all the normal things in your life if you so choose, like working, all that kind of stuff. Along with, you know, we actually show people how to change their relationship with substances if that's what they're looking for as well. So yeah, we don't necessarily teach you that you have to stop forever and that you got a disease and all this kind of stuff. Like, obviously you can stop forever if that's your goal and what you want to do. Awesome. But a lot of people don't want to do that. And yeah, we show people how to achieve that, make that possible, and really, you know, focus on strength-based stuff and finding the different pillars of connection within yourself and your external environment that actually help propel you forward on a trajectory of recovery. So that's what we do. Connection-based living, again, the main premise of what we do is show you how to beat addictive patterns without having to go to rehab. In a different, unique way and in a life setting and environment that works for you. So if that sounds of interest to you, you've wanted to make some changes, or you have a family member that, you know, you've wanted to help that, you know, you think that they need to make changes, or they've thought that they've needed to make changes and things just haven't quite kind of lined up for them, we might be able to help. So check out the links below. You can book in a free call with us. We can have a chat. If we can't help, we can point you in the right direction, because we do come at it in a unique way. Straight off the bat, there is like costs involved, and it is an investment in your health and your future and all that kind of stuff. But as I said, there's no harm in having a chat. Seeing what the options are and if we can help, and if we can't, we can put you in the right direction as I said. So that's connection-based living. Links are in the description. And back into the episode. Thanks, guys. Boost.
You know, I don't discredit, like, I mean, I fucking hate religion. I don't believe in it. Well, I don't believe in God.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't want to discredit that it can help some people. Like,
of course, yeah.
You know, I've seen some people, particularly in the last rehab, where it's like they've been in and out of addiction and prison for like 20, 30 years, you know, and for them, like, that's just their last. They've tried everything. They've tried so many different, you know, techniques and rehabs and whatever, and then they find God, and it's something for them to hold on to and grab onto, and it fills that void.
Yeah.
And you see them, you know, reconnecting with their family or their grandchildren and genuinely being happy and sober. I mean, if that's what it takes for someone else, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, 100%. No, but you're exactly right. I agree, right? I agree. And have seen it help so many people. But it is interesting, like what you said, just the, unfortunately, like, yeah, the lack of regulation in the drug and alcohol rehabilitation space can, yeah, just sort of allow anybody to sort of set up shop and do stuff without, any kind of standards of qualifications and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, often like people go into facilities not really knowing, like, kind of almost like what they're getting into, and they're in such a vulnerable situation, and just, and it makes the whole thing confusing. And the main point is, like what you said, is that it leaves a bit of taste in people's mouth, which then can prevent them from, you know, getting help down the track in some other service that might be more, you know, suitable to them. So, yeah, it's interesting. So that second time you went to rehab, how did that kind of come about? How did you, was it off your own bat, or did you get court ordered, or like, yeah, did you do research into stuff?
So the second one basically was, I mean, the reason I ended up at something so similar was I was in prison and then, you know, wanted to get bailed. There was absolutely no way that I was going to get bail on the charges that I was on unless I was, you know, trying to get into some facility, I guess. So, you know, I couldn't really do much research from inside. And, you know, so with help from family, they just found this place. And really the crux of it was the longest possible program. Like, it was 12 to 18, basically, I mean, 12 to 18 months or something. I mean, you can essentially just live there, which is another thing about these rehabs which freaks me the fuck out. It's like people just get stuck in them. They finish their program, then they become like, you know, like a leader.
Yeah.
And then they become like, it's just this revolving thing, and then they're stuck there for like 3 or 4 years because it's, you know, it's hard to come back into the real world, especially when it's residential and you're not allowed to go, you know, really go out, and you know, you don't see your friends and family like as often as, you know, you might see someone once a month or something.
Yeah.
So to sort of reintegrate, I mean, it'd be the same with people doing a long sentence. Just reintegrating into society is so hard, so they just get stuck in there. But yeah, so that's how I ended up there. Just found the place that would accept me on like, you know, I had a firearms charge. So there was a lot of rehabs that wouldn't take me.
Yeah.
Most of the ones that would were quite short, like a 3-month program. So there was just no way that I'd probably get bailed. So yeah, found this place, and I remember the first, like, I think it was the first week, I just remember being like, I just want to go back to prison. Like, fuck this. Just because of the all the Pentecostal worship and all this stuff, and I was just like, it just doesn't align with my values, you know. But look, I stuck it out. I didn't really have a choice.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, after about 7 or 8 months there, I got sentenced and, yeah, just got put in an order and was, I think I've got 5 months left of it. I'm over a year into it. And that's probably where I've found the most probably the most professional help, really, is via corrections.
Awesome.
It's sort of been the first time where I guess it's secular. So, you know, seeing a good psychologist and some AOD workers, and particularly my corrections manager, I really connected with. Some people aren't so lucky to get a good CM and a good psychologist, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've been pretty lucky, and it's been the first time it's made me, and also being in the real world and just trying to continue on with my career and have these conversations has made me real introspective about a lot of stuff. And it seems to be an easier way for me to work through things.
Yeah. 100%, man. Yeah. It's awesome. It is important to, yeah, like feel like a fucking human, right? And just be able to go to the supermarket, yeah. Just do normal shit. Interesting, man. So I'll come back. So, sorry, we're jumping around a bit here. It's just something that I'm like really interested in, right? And I was talking about it yesterday. So I was away. We're in Adelaide for a government meeting, and we were talking about that stuff just yesterday, because there's a treatment quality standards framework that's been meant to be rolled out by now. That's meant to kind of cover off all this stuff, so you know, make sure that organizations are credible and at least kind of following some standards and things like that. Because yeah, we just hear so many stories of, you know, not just religious, just any kind of places where people have like fucked up experiences. And yeah, it's really sad because they get stuck in addiction and have troubles for much longer. So yeah, sorry, I just get super interested in people's experience with it.
Yeah, yeah.
So you went to rehab that first time, and you kind of slipped back into addiction, and did things kind of get just like way more, it sounds like they got way more intense than it was like previously. And just like, it sounded like you crashed and bashed around a lot in your life, and things got pretty chaotic there for a bit.
Yeah, pretty much, like not directly after rehab. You know, I definitely made a point of not doing drugs and made a conscious decision to sort of, you know, not hang out with certain people, and I didn't necessarily cut anyone out of my life. But I just made sure I wasn't hanging around with some of those people from high school and you know, people who I knew who were using.
Yeah.
I hadn't really dealt with the issues yet, so I just basically replaced drugs with alcohol hardcore for like 5 years. And then when I did crash and burn, you know, it was all thrown into the mix. So, yeah.
And drinking alcohol hardcore is pretty brutal, right?
yeah, it is. I mean, yeah, it's pretty full on, I guess. Like when I got to there was a point where I had to go to hospital for alcohol withdrawals, which is real, it's something I'd never experienced, like in many years of heavy, like really heavy drinking.
Yeah.
It sort of escalated at one point, and I remember just, you know, having these crazy withdrawals and like having to call paramedics and shit, and that was just like, man, I was like, well, it's pretty full on, like, you know. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's benzos and alcohol are the only two drugs that you can die from the withdrawals.
That's it. Yeah, 100%.
Because the heroin withdrawals suck, but they can't kill you.
Correct. Yeah, like from what I know, the heroin withdrawals sound like they kind of feel the worst and the most, like, they seem to be the most, just observing my mates and stuff, the most... not only physically, but like psychologically just kind of like fucks with you for a while, you know, and it's hard to sort of overcome the monkey or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, like in terms of killing you, alcohol and benzos, and benzos seems like it's really fucked to come off as well, you know, just
It's sort of ironic, really, because you go, I mean, if you're coming off alcohol, they put you on benzos. For me, you know, going to hospital and they just pump me with, like, you know, a Diaz drip and oxazepam, and I was just like, I've been eating bricks like Tic Tacs. You're going to need to give me more than that. Like, this is not going to touch the sides.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And did you find with, like, although, you know, you mentioned before, like, mental health and all that sort of stuff, did you find a lot of those drugs, although they kind of give you short-term relief, did you find, like, in the longer term, it just kind of made your mental health worse, you know, particularly with, like, benzos and things like that?
Yeah. I mean, probably goes without saying, but there's also, I mean, it's also like that whole journey is, there's so many conversations that I've had from being on substances that have sort of really informed my worldview in a positive way and sort of shaped the way I am, which is not to, to glorify drug use, but yeah. I think that probably is, you know, where I sit with the, my interest in, like, people having more awareness and understanding about drugs and the legalization and harm reduction as opposed to the stigma attached to them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of negatives in there, but it's not to discount that there are positives from certain drugs and stuff. Like, you know, I wouldn't be where I am now if I hadn't have done all this stuff, and I don't really, you know, I try not to look back, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, Matt. It's cool. It's really cool that you have that perspective. It's because I think that's the way that, yeah, like the conversation, if we're actually going to help people in general with it, like, that's the way that the conversation has to sort of shift and change, you know, like obviously yourself and in my story as well, like, the things got right to the pointy end. And yeah, things weren't so good, but yeah, there's a lot of people that, you know, kind of use drugs and it is, like, positive and it does help them. And if we had that more sort of mature conversation in society about it, you know, we could probably get a lot more people coming forward and asking for help, you know, a lot earlier if they need it, a lot earlier than they do, because it's not stigmatized, you know, all that kind of stuff. It is like really interesting. How were you funding all this? It sounds like you were using a lot. Like, were you working? Like, you know, like, how do you go about, yeah, just what was your life like in this time, when all this different stuff was going on?
I mean, it really, the last stint of years of madness was just funded by dealing drugs.
Yeah.
And it sort of really started to kick off in COVID, I guess. And then throughout the lockdowns and stuff, you know, there's just a lot of time to do fuck all, really. And a lot of people wanting to buy drugs. So, the finance really came from selling. But it wasn't like, for me, it wasn't some sort of junkie type of situation where it's like, fuck, I've got to sell this and then to eat my profit sort of thing. Like, you know, I was being as reckless as I was because I was off my head on the Zans. You know, I was making more than enough to be able to take what I wanted when I wanted and also enjoy the other, you know, the other perks of life, you know, instead of being on the gutter. So there was some sort of, I don't know if control is the right word, but there was some sort of pragmatic decision-making in my experience with dealing. But it was just, with the Xans and alcohol, you're getting sloppy and you make so many mistakes, you don't know what the fuck you're doing, you're putting other people at risk.
But
100%.
And again, it's just like all this stuff is just so interesting because there's just such a black and white narrative put out there in terms of the stereotype of like a drug user or, you know, someone involved in drugs or, yeah, someone dealing drugs or whatever. And it's just like so much more gray than that, you know what I mean? And so many more different elements that kind of go into it. And, yeah, I guess that's why people feel like disconnected from the system and, you know, doing different stuff because, you know, they feel misunderstood. Like, did you have that feeling a lot of the time throughout your throughout, you know, everything that was going on? Was this feeling of misunderstanding? You know, was it hard to kind of connect with people? Like, did you ever like think about yourself like having a different life, doing things differently, or were you just kind of stuck in that vortex that was going on in that time?
I don't think I had the mental capacity to.
Yeah. Like,
I was just, you know, I was on another planet, man.
Yeah.
There was no real time to just sit down and reflect because I was just on one constantly, perpetually,
yeah,
you know, cooking. But yeah, that's probably more of a feeling I felt really in the last years, you know. Have had the capacity to sort of think about that sort of stuff and what my relationship with drugs is, what it, you know, can be, what does the future look like and how do I feel about all this sort of stuff and how do I feel about myself? And,
yeah.
You know, that's been like, you know, yeah, just going through corrections, obviously the rehab passing, you know, having to pass all the piss tests, being on bail.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, my mind was a lot clearer. You know, I jumped back on things when I got out of rehab. And it's been an on and off sort of, you know, tug of war, but definitely, you know, not like it used to be. And slowly sort of, I don't know if it's because I'm getting a bit older or just because I'm engaging more and having these conversations that the relationship I have with drugs and alcohol seems to be definitely shifting and changing.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome, man. Yeah, it's really interesting and cool to hear your perspective because, to be honest, you sound like you're in like a really good place, you know, with things. And yeah, you've come to some pretty like insightful points about stuff, you know. Yeah, it is really interesting. So when you sent me through your bio, you probably have sent me like the coolest kind of bio summary I've ever got. I'm just going to say that, right? So yeah, you're obviously like an artist and I saw that from the Four Corners thing that you did recently as well. How did all that like kind of, you know, play out during that whole time? How has it helped you in like the healing process? Yeah, like what do you plan to do with it? Yeah, I imagine it's been a big part of the whole journey.
Yeah, it's a strange one. I mean, I've been working on my career for like 10 years. And I'll always, you know, always paint because I'm compelled to do it. But I never thought I'd probably reach a point in my life where I'd be interested in doing something else as well.
Yeah.
But coming out, like, you know, I was talking to someone yesterday morning who's, you know, had done 4 years prison and really turned his life around. And, you know, I just mentioned to him about my short stint. You know, I always just would call myself a visitor, really. But, you know, he sort of highlighted to me not to discredit a short sentence because in a way he said for him it was, you know, could be easier when he came out because he was just irrelevant and he was able just to start like a new life.
Yeah.
Whereas I guess for me, the dust hadn't even settled yet within my community. There was a big, you know, sensationalist media blowout in The Age. And so I was still sort of navigating coming back into this art world and dealing with dealing with judgment, dealing with stigma, I guess regaining people's trust. Obviously people just don't want to associate with you. And just sort of learning just how to deal with that and just sort of understand that, you know, people have a right to make their own decision and be on their own journey. I obviously just got to focus on mine. And I haven't made, you know, all the best decisions since I got out of prison, but I've also made some very good ones and had some really good sort of, you know, growth and learning.
Yeah.
So it's been a bit difficult, but I guess all of that's made me really interested in studying criminology and looking at the social aspect and psychological side of offenders and why they offend. And then at some point, I mean, I'd really need to finesse it, I reckon, but seeing the art world and the criminal world sort of intersect somehow would be really interesting. I don't know in what capacity. Art therapy always bugs me the fuck out. Like, I've had some weird experiences with art therapy and rehab, making like fucking macaroni angels and shit.
That's funny, man. Do you know one time we did this? It was actually kind of cool. One time we did this thing. These two therapists they were psychiatrists, right? But they were sort of they were kooks, man. They were like the you know, obviously like a product of like the 70s or whatever. And I was staying at like this youth kind of rehab place or whatever you call it. Anyway, we used to do these groups, and then they came in and they wanted to do it was like drama improv, but it was kind of like pretending that you're in like a mental institution or something, right? So they had us all. There was like 15 of us, right? Pretty fucking crazy. Like, well, most of us are just all off drugs recently. And they had us like running around, and they were like leading us, these like kooky sort of like psychiatrists, running around the building, like just like doing fucking weird shit, like screaming and like, you know, crawling up the wall. And oh man, it was fucking weird. And they said it was like therapeutic. So I've like had heaps of weird experiences as well. I remember doing it thinking, this is fucking weird as.
It sounds like a good way to get put in a mental institution.
That's right. That's right. So like it is hard. Like I found that hard in my journey as well, to work out how to do things that, like I think are cool and might be helpful to people without falling into that stereotypical, in your case, like art therapy and stuff like that. But it sounds like you have this sort of passion to connect with people and try and help in some way, right?
I think that, like, I mean, people who are in addiction or not in addiction, or that maybe they've been sober for 5 years, maybe they've been sober for 6 months, or they're still active, like, still there's some capacity with everyone to connect with someone who's struggling and talk to them. I mean, obviously, I guess it's not really an analogy, but if you've been in and out of addiction for 20 years, you're still probably going to be in a better position to help someone who's in addiction in a really early stage. So I think for me, just, making sure I connect with people and make sure for myself I keep talking about this sort of stuff. I mean, this is why I find podcasts and media shit sort of, obviously, the Four Corners thing is a bit daunting, but stuff like this is really cathartic. Like, it really just, you know, like, I'll turn this screen off after, and I'll probably sit down and, you know, have a good think, and definitely feel a bit lighter after, you know, just chatting about this sort of stuff.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Yeah. Well, I was the same. It's it, it I always used to think, like, how is just like talking about shit going to help me? And then like I would do it, and then yeah, I would just feel better afterwards. So I was just like, all right, I'll keep trying to do it. Can I ask, like, because yeah, I've never been in a situation like that. But yeah, like you mentioned, there was a bit of a media beat up, you know, when things kind of blew up, with your court stuff and whatever. Like, how much of an impact did that have on you, and how did you deal with it? And, you know, like, yeah, how did you like navigate that, if you did at all, or if you just kind of just put your head down and just tried to keep moving?
It really fucked with my mental health at first, like, especially coming out of rehab. Like, I had no idea how, I knew that there was a newspaper article, but I didn't realize that every single fucking person I knew about this story. Like, there wasn't one person in my life that didn't know, even, like, you know, just even in the art community. So it was sort of hard. Like, I'd had a lot of anxiety just going to openings and stuff. I still go out to openings now, but definitely not as much as I used to. But I guess I just sort of, look, at first I isolated a little bit, was pretty scared of just, you know, putting my head out there and getting back into that world. But eventually I just realized, look, I've made some decisions that have changed the trajectory of my life completely that I can't take back. So I just embraced it, really, and just that's when I started to be like, well, all right, I'll do this, you know, I'll do a podcast, I'll do this interview, I'll do that, because, I mean, what else can I really do?
Yeah.
Like, it's easier just to embrace it and have these conversations, even though, you know, like, I made a post on Instagram the other day with a podcast I did with my friend Jack, and it's just really funny because it was recorded about 6 months ago, and you can even hear like an attitude in my voice in it, like, you know, like I sound like a real fucking yobbo and a bit really like real angry at the world sort of thing at points. And you know, I was a bit embarrassed about it, but, you know, like he said to me, like, it's still important, like, these conversations that they mark a point in time in your life, and you get to go back and listen to them and reflect. And by doing that and also having those conversations moving forward, like, you know, I find that, yeah, I'm constantly sort of learning and growing, which I think is really important.
Yeah. Yeah, man. It's cool. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. So, like, I love a silver lining, right? Because what else do you have? But if you're to kind of like reflect on all of this, you know, I'm sure there's probably stuff that's happened that you probably think, fuck, in some ways I wish that didn't happen. But yeah, like, what are some of the big silver linings that you got out of this whole life and experience, I guess, that you've had to date?
I think probably new and like strengthened friendships.
Yeah.
Obviously a massive thing is like losing friends, like, you know, that's like, that's probably the hardest thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it reminds me that I've made a lot of new friends, and then there's a lot of friendships that I had that have just been, yeah, really strengthened. And just having the capacity to be involved in something different, as opposed from just being, you know, this drug taking painter. It's like, you know, I've got the capacity to sort of talk a bit more in a positive light about this sort of stuff, and just sort of bring a bit more awareness to, you know, how serious addiction can be and how it does affect or how it's affected myself and how I affected others and how it can affect others. And just having a bit of a platform is good, I think.
Yeah, 100%. So if I can, again, it's just because I'm interested in different people's like perspectives and, you know, like, yeah, yourself, you're obviously sort of in that point where you're reflecting and sort of somewhat freshly out of, you know, the haze of it all. Like, what do you think about those bigger conversations when you hear them about, you know, like legalizing drugs or decriminalizing drugs, you know, just from like the experiences that you've had? Like, do you think it would be a good thing? Question without notice, sorry.
I think it would be good. I mean, it's a massive, complicated sort of thing. Like, if you were to legalize drugs, there's so many intricate, complicated details that you'd have to comb through. I don't really, like, I had this conversation with a friend a couple of weeks ago, and I was sort of like, I think drugs should be legal, but I can't really see the purpose in making ICE legal.
Yeah.
Because they were sort of like, they were like, you know, well, heroin and ICE shouldn't be legal. And I was like, well, if heroin was regulated and you've got your safe injecting rooms, I mean, people aren't going out and, you know, getting into fights when they're on the nod. They just want to sit on the couch. Like, whereas I was like, but with ICE, I'm like, I can't really see anything positive coming from it. It's a bit complicated, but like, you know, I'd say like marijuana and ketamine are going to be legal in the next 5 to 10 years, probably.
Yeah.
Even for recreational use. There's definitely some positive things that can come from some drugs if it's monitored and regulated. How you do that, I mean, I don't know. I mean, obviously other countries have done it with certain things, and we're using ketamine and cannabis for medical use now. But yeah, I think it's important. I mean, it takes away the stigma.
Yeah.
It takes away the stigma from drug dealers, because I don't know if there'd be any left if we put tax on it.
That's right.
I guess there's still always going to be a black market, but like you said earlier, it gives people the opportunity to stop the situation from spiraling out of control before, you know, because the services are there and the awareness around harm reduction is there. People are going to feel more comfortable just approaching a government body or a council body and seeking help.
Yeah. Like, it's interesting. Like, if you think about all the stuff that happened during like your addiction and, you know, when you're going through some tough kind of moments, would you say that it was actually about the drug use itself, or was it more about all the shit that just comes along with it all, you know, like the different life that you're involved in, with if you're dealing drugs, or, you know, is that all the stuff that causes like most of the pain, would you say? Like, all the things that come along with it, not necessarily the actual drug taking itself. Obviously, it causes some pain, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it goes both ways. Like, with, you know, during my time dealing drugs, there's obviously, apart from just the physical effects, but yeah, fucking up people's emotions and upsetting friends around you is, you know, it's a shit thing. But I also made a lot of friends from drug dealing, like, and just people I met from doing a deal that I'm still really close to today, like super close with, and we have really, really healthy conversations. And it's like, to me, it's really it's irreplaceable. It's sort of a weird, that's a weirder silver lining. But
it's true though.
And seeing some of those people, you know, go through probably not the height of addiction that I was sort of at, but, you know, have a bit of a tough time and I was still always, you know, ready to cut people off and talk to them about their use if they wanted to. And yeah, seeing people actually sort of just reach out for help and seeing them now and where they're at. And, you know, quite a few friends are sober that I met through dealing. Some aren't, but some are doing really well or managing it. And then obviously there's some people that are just out of control that I just obviously don't involve myself with. But it's interesting.
Yeah, awesome. And just finally, I guess like the experience that you've had with, and you sort of touched on a little bit, but like with rehab services, like going through prison for that time, being involved with corrections, you know, all that kind of stuff. Like, what have you found to be for you like some of the most healing sort of like activities or aspects, like what's really helped you so far, do you think, to make changes in your life?
Just being open and talking to people, really. And that includes, you know, that includes my appointments that I have to do for corrections. In that aspect, physically having to go somewhere and be accountable for making a meeting. And then, you know, having a open chat with someone, you always leave feeling a lot better or learning something about yourself. And just making sure I'm honest with my friends. And if I'm not, making sure that I acknowledge that and talk to them about it. Just communication. Like, I mean, communication is just the best foundation for anything, really. If it's not consistent, then it's useless.
Yeah, 100%.
I think just being open and talking about it has been the best thing for me personally, because every time I have a conversation like this, like, you know, learn something and or it just reiterates something that I believe in that I can reflect on more.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Awesome. Hey, well, it was a pleasure having you on, and yeah, thanks for coming on and telling us a bit about you and your story and stuff. And, you know, even though you want to, I don't take it lightly, because yeah, it can be a bit of a strange like process and dance to walk. So yeah, I appreciate it, mate. I appreciate it. I don't know, like, do you have anything that you're like doing that you want to like kind of put out there? Is do you have like any art stuff that you have people to visit? Like, where could people find you if they want to hear more about your story and what you do and all that kind of stuff?
Just my Instagram. I think it's just Benjamin_Aitken_art. I'm just sort of lately, you know, just been posting some of the work that I'm doing or work that I got coming up, but I've been including posting any media involvement and podcasts I'm doing, and just before shit hit the fan, like, I lived a pretty public profile on Instagram.
Yeah,
definitely the Zannies didn't help posting some shit that should never have been posted on there. And I remember a friend saying to me, you know, because when I sort of come out of this and was like, yeah, just really anxious about being judged and whatever, you know, I sort of shut down and, like, you know, disactivated my Instagram and just made like a little personal one for friends. And a friend said to me, like, you know, you've lived a public sort of life, whether it was savory or not, it's not even questionable. But you know, I sort of owe it to some people to let them continue on that journey with me. So instead of just sort of being a hermit now, I'm just sort of getting used to, posting these podcasts so people can listen, and, like, which has been really good. I get a lot of people who reach out, and apologies to my request inbox. I'll get to that. people just, you know, who are just going through stuff and reaching out, and I think that's really sort of not rewarding, but positive.
Awesome, man. Awesome. Well, I'll make sure I put that in there, because I'm sure people will be be interested to check it out. But yeah, hey, thanks for coming on again, mate. I really appreciate it, and we'll have round two, I'm sure, in the not too distant future.
Pleasure, Jack.
Cheers, mate.